Session number 15105, Reel 2.
Mr. Tipton, Reel 2.
As I said, you spent 2 hours over the target as a single aircraft, and the idea was to really to keep noise and going mainly through their anti-aircraft fire rather than your bombs, so that you disturbed the sleep of the dockers and made them a little more tired the next day. For example, at Naples, what you would do would be to drop a bomb in the harbour, aiming, of course, if you could, at something worthwhile, a ship in the harbour, and they would fire, usually pretty wildly, and you'd pop over to Capri or Vesuvius until they stopped again, and then you'd go back and start again and keep it going for your 2 hours, and you were then relieved by somebody else and you returned back to Malta. Sometimes it was possible to be quite effective given the right conditions, and in one Brindisi raid, I remember, the aircraft before us had hit some oil tanks and they were going quite nicely, and we were able to use our time reinforcing that, in which case we were not so concerned in dropping the occasional bomb, but maybe making a better job of the job they had started, if you see what I mean. That was the main sort of operation, and of course the Tripoli and Benghazi, they were much more deliberate attacks on shipping by the whole squadron. There was another squadron, a Wellington squadron in Malta at the time, which was 104. They were Wellington Mark IIs, which had Merlin engines. The big feature of them was that they could carry a 4,000-pound bomb. The other squadrons at Lucca, of course, were the Blenheims, and they had a disgusting job. We could only fly at night. We were too vulnerable in day. The Blenheims, who attacked convoys, and also sometimes used to do overland attacks in North Africa, they had to get off the island and back to the island in daylight. And this was extraordinarily difficult when the Germans were there, because they could maintain a standing patrol. So the Blenheims had an extremely difficult time.
Did you converse with them?
Oh, yes. And we knew what a hard time they were having. There were odd people amongst them that we had seen before in training and that sort of thing. But at that time, Blenheims generally, I think, had a hard time. I know that from my bobbing and gunnery school, only a few of us went to Wellingtons. The majority of them went to Blenheims. And I think quite a lot of our contemporaries had been become casualties before we had even left the Wellington OTU, because the Blenheim OTU was obviously shorter, because it was for daylight operations. And Malta was one of the worst places for them, because the Germans were able to keep fighters pretty well on the spot.
How dangerous were your operations on the ports?
They rather varied. In comparison with the operations in Germany, we considered that they were not dangerous at all. On the other hand, some of them could be. It depended on the conditions which you had, because we did some low-level attacks on Tripoli Harbour, for example, which could be very unpleasant. But our losses, actually, on air operations were not heavy. Where we were in trouble in Malta was losing aircraft on the ground. The technique for the Wellingtons was that there was an old airfield called Safi, I think, which was down the road from Lucca, and there was a pathway, a little roadway, from Lucca down to it. And at Safi, a whole lot of pens for Wellingtons had been built out of sand-filled 4-gallon drums, oil cans, they're square. And so before operations, at the very last light, the second pilot used to go down to Safi and then taxi the aircraft up onto the airfield at Lucca at last light. A tricky business, because the track was not very wide and it was easy to slip off and get bogged down. And then you at your operation returned, it was still dark, and the unfortunate second pilot had to stay up on the airfield until the first glimmer of dawn that he could see to taxi the aircraft back into its 4-gallon sand drum protection down at Safi. But even so, of course, a lot of aircraft were lost on the ground. As a matter of fact, in rather a heavy loss, towards the end of December, we were at our aircraft waiting to take off with the whole squadron lined up, and our aircraft was hit by an intruder and exploded, and that damaged pretty well every aircraft in the squadron to some extent, varying according to the distance they were parked from us at the time, and so that you were very vulnerable on the airfield, and so the only sort of safe thing to do was to tuck the aircraft away on Safi. But you could still do the losses.
How do you spell Safi?
S-A-F-I, I think. Yes. There could be two A's in it, but I think...
Did you have any narrow escapes actually on operations from Malta?
You don't know about a narrow escape, really, because you don't know how closely they missed you, but... there were certainly occasions when we had sort of heavy anti-aircraft opposition in some of these ports, because you were often the only aircraft and you were often quite low. The nastiest occasion, of course, was when they hit our aircraft and blew it up, which obviously wasn't too good. Sergeant Sunley was killed, and our rear gunner lost a leg in that one, and everybody was sort of dusted a little with bits and pieces out of that one. We were very lucky.
And you?
Oh, I only had a couple of small pieces in my leg. It was no problem. I was limping around for a couple of weeks.
What was everyday life like in Malta under the siege?
It wasn't too good, because when we first went to Malta, there was a hospital which had been built, I think, in 1915 for Gallipoli, just off the airfield, and all the Lucca air crew were in it. I found this to my surprise, because it was also being run, half of it was still a convent, and they had leper patients. And when we arrived, as I described, in the middle of the night at Lucca, found a bed in a sort of large rooms in this place. We found an empty bed, and I went to sleep there. Got up in the morning and grasped a towel and went off to seek for a bathroom, and immediately walked into two or three nuns who were walking outside. Then we found out where we were. Eventually, and before very long, the state of the bombing on Lucca was such that they split the squadrons up. All the air crew in this one place. Too many eggs in one basket, and so we went to a village called Nashar in the middle of Malta, and the other squadrons went to various places, and so that we were a little safer, in that a hit on this hospital at the wrong time would have been pretty serious from an aircrew point of view. But when we were in this hospital, the attacks on the airfield were pretty continuous. And so your days were greatly disturbed by the anti-aircraft batteries, of course, which were sort of outside your window and very close too. So disturbed, because there was so much raiding. And when we were out and about, you found yourself ducking into the air raid shelters quite a bit. And then we used to go down into Valletta when we could, and have a meal and... drink down there. There was very little to do, really. When we were out of this place in Nashau, we were at the local nobleman's palace. Then it was a little better, because we had sufficient room to be able to play cards and things like that, which was something. But otherwise, we operated pretty intensively, so we didn't get a lot of time.
Did you suffer from poor food?
The food was rotten, I thought. Well, it was. At that time, of course, it was getting very short. And my impression was that we were having McConaughey's meat and vegetable stew 3 times a day, because it seemed to be the one thing of which they had plenty. One day, very shortly after the war, and I was married. My wife had then come out of the Air Force, and she proudly came home one day with a tin of this stuff, which she'd found with great difficulty. And that's the whole idea of eating it then. I hadn't got over the shock of having to eat it for quite so long, so many times. There's nothing wrong with the stew, but monotonously, it was pretty awful. The food was not good.
Did you have much to do with the Maltese civilians?
Not a lot, except sort of mainly in the bars in the town, really. I think you've got a great respect for them. People used to comment when they first arrived. I remember we had a warrant officer on the squadron, a ground crew, who was always... He used to comment about the way the Maltese who worked for him used to rush off to the shelter. This was when he first arrived. It wasn't long before he was racing them, I think. And Maltese had put up with a very hard time for a long time. And you got to respect them and like them. I've been back since, so I like them very much indeed.
What did their attitude towards the war seem to be?
One would have thought it possible that the Maltese would consider it as a war that we had brought to their doorstep. But I don't think they saw it that way. Certainly today they don't see it that way. They regard it as a war in which we were both in it together. And I think at the time, to a great degree, they did the same. Of course, there were the Malta units, the Malta artillery, for example, which was fighting away like everyone else. And so I think they did regard it as something, very sensibly. Even if we hadn't been there, the Germans would have invaded Malta because of its strategic position. So at least we were helping them keep the Germans out. They'd have come to them anyway.
How long were you in Malta for?
Well, not terribly long. We actually left because it was no longer sustainable. And we left in the middle of February, 42. And by that time, we really would not be able to sustain aircraft. When we flew out, we flew to Chalufa in the canal zone, and it so happened that ours, I think, was the only fully serviceable, or wasn't all that fully, but only serviceable Wellington on the squadron that night. And so we went, and the others had to wait for serviceable aircraft. Sometimes they were picking up aircraft which were actually destined for the Middle East anyway, which were often picked off in Malta, which is one of the ways we'd sustained the squadron during the period we were there, was really hijacking aircraft which were coming through from OTUs bound for the Middle East.
What dates did you leave Malta?
Left on the 16th of February. No, I'm sorry. That's right, 16th of February.
What was everybody's physical and mental condition like by the time you got out?
I think we were tired. Really, I honestly think we suffered from an overall lack of sleep. We had only ever flown at night, of course, the whole time we were in Malta, and the days were frequently difficult. There was always some raiding going on which made noise, and so that weary, I think, people were. Worn out a bit by that time.
What happened to the squadron in Egypt?
Well, it never came back. Of course, when we went out, we had the idea that we were merely on a detachment and would be returning to Witten, and so we'd left a lot of our kit behind. But in fact, what happened was that we were returned as tour-expired aircrew by flying down to Lagos. Not in our aircraft, of course. There were some Dakotas flown by Americans. And so we went down to Lagos, and the squadron, as a number, remained in the Middle East for the rest of the war. I think he went to India at one time, but they ended up on Liberators, I think.
And what happened to you?
Having got to Lagos, we came back via Freetown by boat, came home on leave, thereby missing the 1,000 bomber raids, which took place during my leave. I was then put on a posting to go on a lecture tour, bond-selling tour to America, intending then to become an instructor at an RAF OTU to be set up in America. While I was waiting for the boat, all that was cancelled. And so actually I went back to Pershore, where I had trained, this time as an instructor.
Instructing in what?
Instructing operational instructing Wellington crews.
Still Wellingtons?
Still Wellingtons, oh yes.
How long did you do that for?
I was there for a year.
Did you enjoy it?
Very much, I think, yes. It was very, Pershore was very nice. Worcestershire is a lovely county. Worcester itself is a nice place for recreation. And the job was one I knew. It was satisfying in that you were trying to turn out operational crews that you hoped might have a chance of survival.
How did you feel about being out of operations?
Obviously, pretty good, I suppose. You knew you were going to go back, but as it happened to everybody, your tour expired and you went to an OTU to teach. It was routine. That's not really what you expected. You knew that a year or was about the time when you would then be returning to operations. It was a normal thing.
What happened to you then with a new operational squadron?
Well, I went to Mosquitoes, to 109 Squadron, which was an oboe squadron, which, having established the operational effectiveness of oboe, was then with a small number of aircraft and crews who had done a lot of development work, then was at the point of expansion. And the way I went there was that I went on leave with some friends to Torquay and met an Australian pilot at Torquay who was from 109 Squadron. He happened to say to me that he was on a Mosquito Squadron. He didn't talk about oboe, of course, which was extremely secret at the time, and that they were on the point of expansion and were seeking second tour navigators. So I said, mention my name when you get back, and I went back to Pershore and said to the senior navigation officer that this was an opportunity, and the next thing I was posted to 109 Squadron at Witten. I was back at Witten where I'd started in the first place. Then I was on Ober Mosquitoes. It was a chance, really. But it opened up a sort of avenue because quite a lot of people I knew who were the instructors at Pershore followed along, pilots and navigators, to 109 Squadron. Quite a few of them came. Otherwise, the normal thing was to crew up. Of course, the Lancaster was in at that time. And if I hadn't gone to Mosquitoes, I would certainly have formed a Lancaster crew. And normally, the crews formed up by instructors then went to the Pathfinder Force, which had just opened up. And so that was the normal avenue. So it was the Pathfinder Force anyway. But because of this meeting at Torquay, I happened to go to Mosquitoes instead of Lancs.
Which group was this?
Eight group.
Can you tell me about flying in the Mosquito, what it was like?
Oh, obviously, it was delightful. What I liked about it particularly, of course, it had a crew of two, because crews were growing, and, of course, the Lancaster crew was bigger than the Wellington crew. And so I was not particularly fond of large crews, because it put up the complication, put up the time. If you were going on comparatively simple flight in the Lancaster, there was so much preliminary settling down, the cockpit drills and so on, which was tedious. Being able to slip into a Mosquito, just two of you, it was very much more pleasant. I certainly enjoyed it. And of course, once you were in a Mosquito, it was a delightful aircraft. And apart from operations, it was fun to be in, because you skittered around so fast, you know. Very nice for a navigator, because you were sitting out there in full view instead of being shut away in some cabin surrounded by gubbins and radar sets, which, of course, had grown since the day when I said when you had a chart and a sextant. Well, all sorts of things were available by that time. And it was much more open. They were fast, they were fun, and it was very pleasant.
What did the oboe equipment look like?
The oboe equipment, the aircraft, just looked like a few large grey boxes, fairly faceless things with a couple of knobs on, all tucked away in the nose of the Mosquito.
What did you have to do?
Oboe, as you probably know, was a ground control of aircraft by radar means. The aircraft actually flew on a beam, an extremely narrow one. The width of the equisignal of the beam was really inside the wingspan of the aircraft. But of course it wasn't a beam, in that your normal beam radiating from a point tended to spread with range. As the oboe beam was merely a measurement of range, it didn't expand at all, of course. And so the other thing, of course, it was curved, because you flew at a constant range from a ground station. And so you flew on a curve on this extremely narrow beam, which meant that the pilots had to be particularly skilled in beam flying. When I went to the squadron, I joined an Australian who was new to operations, but having come over from Australia, he went on a blind approach course and was so good at it they kept him as an instructor. And so he came from being a bat instructor to oboe because of his skill on beam flying. And we started together. So you had two signals, really. The pilot had this very, very narrow beam. The navigator had a radar signal from another ground station which was measuring your range along the beam and gave you four check position points down the run, and then actually gave you your bomb release signal. So that the set operation for the navigator in the aircraft on the bombing run, which was approximately 60 miles of straight and level flying down the beam, set operation was merely ensuring that the signal was good and clear. The pilot had this very narrow beam to fly, so he was concentrating like mad with his seat down to the bottom so that he could concentrate entirely without seeing anything. And he would indicate if there was any roughness in his signal, because the navigator would be listening to his own, of course. And then you could switch over to the pilot's signal and tune up the signal to a fine point. That was really the only set operation you had to do with the oboe equipment. There was navigation equipment, of course, and a G-set.
What did the bomb release signal sound like?
It was three dots and a dash, and you bombed on the break of the dash.
And the G equipment? What did you have to do with that?
Oh, G equipment was just the standard G navigation equipment, which gave you a position. By this time, G, which had come in 1942, I think, was being jammed, and so its effective range had been shortened by German jamming. But what it did give you, of course, was a very good start, in that. Initially, you had some very accurate navigation aid from G, so you were able to project yourself out of the G range, if you like, on a very accurate course for the initial point of the oboe run. And then it took 10 minutes to fly from the initial point down to the target. Our job was to drop markers, of course. So in order to keep markers going, what you had were a series of aircraft. Ground control, the ground station could only control one aircraft on a frequency at a time. And so you had aircraft coming on different frequencies so that you were following one another down at something like 2-minute intervals. But the individual aircraft had this 10-minute straight and level run then with the complete concentration of the ground station on him. And as soon as you switched off, they picked up another at the waiting point.
What did the markers look like?
They depended. They were either green or red, depending on the coding that was being used. They were, pyrotechnic bombs.
The coding for that operation?
Yes, that's right. Because it rather depended on cloud conditions, which you could drop markers above cloud. So that they would actually open above the cloud, then the main force aircraft on a predetermined heading could actually bomb through the marker, which was at a certain height. So the trajectory of their bombs go through the marker to the aiming point. But in the main, it was ground marking, and that you were putting the markers down on the ground. And of course, Oboe could do it with very great accuracy compared with anything that had gone before.
Did you feel yourself to be members of an elite force?
Oh, I think definitely, because we were able to mark with our markers, or with bombs, if you like, with a greater degree of accuracy than any other thing that had come about. And of course, there were few of us, because Oboe could only cope with very few aircraft. So we had just the one squadron, and then later, with expansion, we were joined by 105 Squadron, which was a squadron with a very great reputation as a low-level daylight bombing squadron. They turned to Oboe to high-level markers. Then we had two squadrons on it. But that was all. And then we did all the Pathfinder marking within the range of the Oboe equipment. And, of course, you were restricted by visual range, which is why we used Mosquitoes, because you could get higher and therefore further.
When did you start off with your operations with the squadron?
Well, I went to 109 Squadron in June 43. Now, it was... Oboe had started in December 42, I think, as a going system. But, of course, its first real operation was in March 43, when it led the main force to attack not just the Ruhr and not just Essen, but the Krupps factory. And that is really the first time that a specific factory in the Ruhr had been attacked, greatly to the German surprise, I think, and did great damage to the Krupps factory as such, whereas before in the Ruhr you were attempting to see something through the constant industrial haze and there was nothing to see. But when the Oboe markers went onto the Krupps factory, that was it. And so March was the proof of the success of the Oboe system. And so after that, then they started expanding and I arrived there in June.
Do you remember your first operation with them?
First operation was, in fact, oddly enough, exactly the same as the last operation in Europe, or Northern Europe, that I had done with Wellington's, which was to Duisburg, I think.
When was that?
That was in July. We had to work up. I'd arrived in the squadron in June, but of course there was no operational training unit for Mosquitoes in those days. You trained on the squadron, and so I joined a pilot, and we learned the Mosquito together, and so it was something like 4 weeks before we actually began operation. And then initially, your first couple of trips, you were not marking for main force. You were actually dropping bombs, because they were really sort of operational exercises, if you like, with orchestral effects.
What were the German defences like by now?
Well, for Mosquito, of course, you were flying high. So although you could have pretty severe anti-aircraft, you were alone up there, really, so you saw all you got. But you didn't have the blanket anti-aircraft, which the main force would be getting below you, because you were always above the main force.